Full service radio.
Hey everybody, it's Nikki Nellis of Foodie and the Beast. You know me from Foodie and the Beast and the list areyouonit.com. And this is our new show, Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. Of course, today I am beastless, so it's just me rocking it out here at the Line Hotel. And I'm so excited about our show today. Today we are talking to Chef Amy Brandwine, who is such a good friend of mine. I've known her. Oh my God, I've known her for
almost 20 years.
I know. I've known her since I started in this industry, and I think since she started in this industry. So we've been friends for a really long time. She is a Rammy nominated chef and a James Beard nominated chef, and she is up to some amazing things at her own restaurant, Centralina. And, you know, DC is sorely lacking in women chefs and women empowerment. And she is on the forefront and she is doing some amazing things. And she actually is the one who brought to my attention Julie Kirkwood. Julie is the founder of DC Urban Greens. And Julie is in studio today. She brought with her Leonard Watson, who is the community liaison and urban farmer, and Avery Snipes, who is the operation manager also at DC Urban Greens. And we are going to talk about the food deserts in D.C., which, I mean, given when we think of D.C., I mean, here we are at the, you know, lovely Line Hotel. We have restaurateurs like Spike Gerdy and Eric Bruner Yang, and there are restaurants popping up all over the D.C. metro area. Too many to choose from. There's tons of fast casual concepts happening. And there are markets and farmers markets happening all over the city, except in two wards. Ward 7 and Ward 8 are sorely lacking in food access. And that's one of the big things we're going to talk about today. But before we dive in super deep, Amy, I'd love to just introduce the people here at Full Service Radio to you and Centralina and what you're doing there.
Thank you, Nikki. So I'm a Washingtonian, born and raised, and I opened Centralina in the spring of...
I love that you say it correctly because
Centralina.
Yes, David should be here because you know my Italian sucks.
Yes, so Centro is center, and Lina is sort of an Italian suffix that makes things feminine and small. So when I was thinking about the restaurant, I was thinking of something feminine, thinking something about in the center, because we're right inside the center of Washington, D.C., downtown.
In city center.
In city center. So, you know, I opened in June of 2015, and, you know, we just hit it right out of the gate. It was so thrilled. And we, you know, my idea was always to bring amazing produce and products and amazing Italian products like that are unique, hard to find, and what I like to cook with, to bring it to bear into the marketplace. And so to have a conversation about food where, you know, you can cook like a chef if you have access to the products that we have. And so I always thought that, you know, part of the magic of chefs is the product they use. So, you know, Italian cuisine is very much about getting the best product and then doing very little to just amplify it and not hide anything. So,
well, Italians believe that you don't need to manipulate the food
right
in order to make it fabulous.
Right.
And you have attached to your, as a part of your restaurant, this amazing market, which you have amazing Italian pastas, but you also have a lot of sort of helpers, I like to call them. You know, you have sauces and pastas and you have fresh fish. So people could literally pick up things there and go.
Yeah, I mean, the entire idea about Centralina was to create a place where people can get amazing products, whether it's raw or prepared. So we make fresh pasta and sauces, and everything that we prepare for the restaurant is most everything. The staple items are available for sale in the market. So the idea is that somebody can get off work or shop during the middle of the day and go home, and within 20 minutes you can have an amazing fresh meal. And I do that myself when I'm on the run and I'm trying to prepare dinner for friends or family. I bring things home, and before you know it, your dinner's on the table in 20 minutes, and it's all fresh, and it's all without tons of fat, and it's really delicious. So
I think that's sort of the luxury that that we have in living in DC for, you know, some people mm-hmm. like me and a lot of people, you know, who live in this area, we have access to prepared foods, fabulous markets, fabulous produce. We have access and we also have the funds mm-hmm. or we put our money aside to spend on those things. But not all people have that luxury. And Julie, I want to come to you now because you are the founder of DC Urban Greens and you saw a need. And I'd like to I'd like to introduce you and sort of find out what need you saw and how you effected it.
So thank you. And hi, thanks for having me.
I love having you here.
So like what you said, I also have access to these things from funds or the desire. And not to say that I always eat beautifully and perfectly, but I can. And that's what I have, but not what everybody has. And so I noticed in my children that when I feed them high sugar, high fat type of foods, that their behavior really declines. And I got thinking one time, you know, it's like I have the opportunity to feed them whatever I want, and not everybody does. And so from a social justice issue, this food access problem is a really big deal. And it hit me that when I see my youngest son, actually is the one in particular, who when he eats, you know, pancakes loaded with syrup for breakfast, and it's all basically straight sugar, and his attitude declines and his attention goes off and you can't get him to even behave normally, it occurred to me, you know, this really impacts our children in the way that they can respond socially, the way that they can react in school and things like this. And so if a child then is fed high sugar, high processed foods all the time, because these are the least expensive and
they're cheap.
And they're shelf stable, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have little access to a grocery store and you can't get to a grocery store.
But you can go to the bodega.
And if you are going to go to the grocery store, you're going to get stuff that can stay in your cupboards as long as humanly possible, so you don't have to go back anytime soon on that long trip, right? And so if this is what you eat all the time, this is what your behavior is going to be based on my personal witness of my own child, and it really, truly would affect our children's ability to learn and grow. And this kind of just hit me, like, really strong that not everybody has the opportunity to amend that problem for their personal, you know, for their child.
So what was the, so that's your aha moment for you personally. Mm-hmm. How did you take that moment and recognize what was going on for other people?
Well, it came with the realization kind of at the same time that I had, you know, the luxury of the ability to fix the problem, but not everybody did. And so living in close proximity to DC and Ward 7 and 8 and food desert neighborhoods, it seemed, you know, one time I saw this this little card that said, somebody asked, why doesn't anybody do anything about it? And then I noticed I am anybody,
right?
You know? And so I was afforded the opportunity to be able to try and do something. And so I started DC Urban Greens. And
what is the overall mission of DC Urban Greens? What did it start as? And then we can talk about how it grew, because we have two people here who do a lot of work within DC Urban Greens, and they really show the efforts of what was started.
Yeah, well, so it's one of those things when you're like have an idea in your head and it doesn't turn out to be anything like you thought it would.
And it's called evolution. It's a good thing. That's what's supposed
like
to
that.
Happen.
Yeah, so originally I was experimenting with these ideas. There's this thing called aquaponics, which is like a closed cycle system where you can grow fish and lettuce at the same time, and it's being used a lot in urban environments and things like that. And so I literally had a prototype of a pond of fish in my garage, okay, where I was trying to grow vegetables and fish. And one day I had like a crisis moment where I was like, oh my goodness, we're gonna have a shop where somebody comes in to buy a fish and a head of lettuce. Like, what good is that for anybody? So that kind of went to the side. But as time it developed into plain old straight in the ground, let's grow food in small, underutilized, very urban locations. Let's employ people from the neighborhood. These are low-income neighborhoods with high levels of unemployment. Let's teach people how to grow, and then let's make that food available to the communities. And essentially, it becomes like a little microeconomic niche.
Mm-hmm. And so, which came first? Did the land come first, or hiring from the community came first? Like, how did you enter into that? Because it sounds like it would be, I mean, you have to raise funds. There sounds like so many walls in the way to make that a reality.
So I have a background in construction, and I still work in construction, but at the time I was employed as a construction project manager, and the owner of the project that I was working on, he and I were having a discussion one day, and I was a little bit disgruntled, kind of overworked, and he said, "Well, if you could do anything, what would you do?" And I said, "I would grow food in the city." And he said, "Well, that's kind of crazy that you have." And I rolled out the concept of DC Urban Greens, and he thought it was a little unusual that I just had this idea already there sitting on the bench. And he said, "Well, if you ever end up doing it, I'll do it with you."
Okay.
And so I have a partner in this business. His name is Vince Fort. But so he actually is on and has long been on the board at Fort DuPont Ice Arena, which is the place where we have our very first garden, because his kids were skating there years ago. And when his kids stopped skating, he didn't stop being on the board. Mm-hmm. And so he had an in, and he knew that they had been trying to establish a program where they could connect not only the sports side of their programming, but bring it together with health for an overall well-being program. And so they had been looking to grow food and have a garden at their site. And so it was quite convenient that I was looking for a site.
Okay, so you know construction, but
yes,
did you know gardening?
I had grown a tomato in my backyard
before. Right, and I heard something about fish and lettuce. I mean, I hear where you're going. But is that when you started your outreach to bring people in who could create these urban gardens?
No.
Okay.
So everything... I really believe you've got to do everything 100% before you could ever ask anybody else to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so my staff knows I have mountains of books. And no, I didn't grow anything other than a tomato in the backyard before. And so I read and I read and I went out and I toured and I looked at who was doing what, and I decided which what was working and what wasn't. And I figured out who the best farmers were and then tried to do what they're doing. And basically kind of created a hybrid model. And for the first almost 2 years, kind of did it without anybody.
Okay. And what did you do? Because I don't think we're being really clear of what this urban garden looks like.
Okay. So if we go to Google Earth and look, for the last 30 years before we arrived at Fort DuPont Ice Arena, there was just a hard slab of grass. And what we did is we took a tiller, and we put in these 100-foot hoop houses, three of them, and I think we start out with maybe 36 beds at that site or something, maybe, I don't know, 30.
And what did you want to grow there? What were you planning on growing?
Vegetables, and we had a strategy. We wanted to grow things that were quick in turnover so that mm-hmm. we could produce a lot of things or a lot of food in a small period of time in the small spaces that we have. So we weren't going to grow cabbages and potatoes. We were going to grow greens that we could cut and recut and grow and things like that quickly.
And what was your plan to get it to the neighborhood? How did you see it from once you grew it, what were you going to do with it? What was the initial plan?
Well, the initial plan was to have farm stands and set up farm stands, except for when you're a white girl in a neighborhood of color mm-hmm. and you're setting up a farm stand at a little table on a hill where there has been nothing for 30 years, it's not very successful. And so, but it takes that in order for people to kind of start looking and noticing, because when you have a concept in your head, until it's developed in the ground, you really can't bring anybody else in to participate.
So when did Leonard join the team?
So Leonard has been with us for the last year, and Leonard actually came to us through our job training program. And so last year we decided we were going to do a job training program where we were going to teach people from the neighborhood surrounding our Ward 8 farm to grow food. And so Leonard shows up on the first day before the instructors showed up. Yes, he's waiting at the gate. And lucky for us, he's never left.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you for joining us today. So what did you see that this organization was doing that you wanted to be a part of?
Well, at the beginning, I didn't see anything the organization was doing. I was curious to learn how to grow. I came across a flyer that was talking about DC Urban Greens agriculture program. So I said, wow, let me go and check it out. I had, you know, I was ambitious about growing, but didn't know how to grow. In fact, I didn't know you can grow in Washington, D.C.
You didn't know you can grow in the city?
I didn't know, you know. So I said, well, just like an opportunity that you can come up and learn how to grow as well. It was a stipend that was attached to it.
Okay.
When I got there, I was accustomed to hard work, but I said, this farming is kind of hard. I didn't know if I could stick in this, you know.
Farming's not easy.
And being there for a while, you know, Julie is a stickler about reading and being more knowledgeable about what you're doing. So I would go home and I would read and I'd come back with different ideas. And DC Urban Greens is a pretty small organization and you become like a family type environment. And I realized that the two founders, Julie and Vince, was like angels, you know. And Vince and Julie
that's so sweet.
Yeah, they came up and asked me, do I want to continue on? And it was my pleasure.
But so you're a community liaison, but you're also now a farmer.
Yes.
So what does that, for the uninitiated, what does that mean? Are you in there farming every day? And are you out there shaking hands with people to tell them more about DC Urban Greens? Like, what is your role?
I guess I'm a hybrid. You know, I spend a lot of time doing urban farming, community liaison as needed. It's periods of times where I had to do a little more community outreach.
Well, I was going to ask, how important... To me, the community liaison role must be very important because you must have a lot of people who would be suspicious.
Yeah, I failed to mention that I am a resident living in the food desert as well.
Okay.
And when I got there and got knowledgeable about food insecurities and living in food deserts and, you know, started gaining more nutritional knowledge from DC Urban Greens, it kind of upset me. To learn that I was living in a community that was actually a food desert. The part of the ward that I live in, I'm probably in the oasis of the desert because I can walk probably two blocks. But when I look at my community, I've seen a lot of correlations with food insecurities and
poor health,
chronic health conditions,
right.
Obesity, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. As well as it started bothering me, like, you know, how's one supposed to learn and not even getting a healthy start in my community? So it was a calling for me to try to help produce as much if I can in this community because it was very upsetting to me to learn that I was actually living in the food desert and amongst those who are food insecure.
So how do you go about as a liaison in the community, how do you go about introducing people to what DC Urban Greens is doing and what you're doing as an urban farmer, letting people know that this product is available and that you're doing what you can to change the narrative from it being a food desert to a food oasis?
Right. Again, living in Ward 8, we have the lowest everything that's probably positive and the highest everything negative. So this wasn't nothing new to me. I kind of embraced this. I said, well, this is another area where that needs to be addressed. So I had no problem with going out into community meetings, talking to the ANC commissioners, council members, my community as a whole, trying to, you know, kind of wake them up on what's actually going on, you know, because at the end of the day, it's the kids that suffer, you know. So I looked at the numbers of, you know, it's a lot of disparities going on when you look at east of the Anacostia River.
Sure.
That makes up more than three-fourths of food deserts. in Washington, D.C., and Ward 8 alone is 51% of the total.
I mean, it's really,
yeah.
It's a crime is what it is.
Yes.
That, you know, we can look at other areas in different wards of D.C. where they're so flush with food options, not mm-hmm. just restaurants and markets, but farmers. I mean, there's so much opportunity. And right. the fact that, you know, Ward 8 and Ward 7 specifically are just cut out completely. And it's, I mean, it is organizations like DC Urban Greens and several others that are trying to change that. Yes, you want to say something,
Julie? Yeah, I did. Thanks. I wanted to say that, so with Leonard, the tide has turned for DC Urban Greens when Leonard came along, because we were getting really good at mastering methodology for growing food. Mm-hmm. But none of that matters if we can't meet our mission of getting that food into the community and the thing that Leonard brought up about community awareness. And so when Leonard came along, and I will tell you, he has got a spectacular reputation amongst his neighbors. Okay, so he's a very well respected member of the community. And so when he speaks, people listen. And he took us out into, like he mentioned, the neighborhood commissions and things like that, garnered letters of support for our organization, which we are now able to attach to grants, which will allow us to have better funding. And so that piece was absolutely essential to our success in the neighborhoods, because if we're just growing food and nobody knows it and we're not getting funding and nobody cares, it doesn't matter, what we do.
It's like if a tree falls in the forest.
Yeah.
So, okay, so how many farms piece. How many farms do you have now?
We've got two.
You have two
one
farms.
One in Ward 7 and one in Ward 8.
And where does Avery fit in? Avery
Snipes, is our operations manager.
So what is Avery doing in over here with DC Urban Greens? You got to come up to the mic and you got to talk.
Okay. It varies.
Okay.
So I started first with mm-hmm. Actually getting to farm, which was really awesome. Mm-hmm. I came with an ag background, but just as Julie was saying, you learn by doing, and I'd never lived in a city or farmed in a city. So everything that I have learned about agriculture has been through Julie Kirkwood or from her trusting me to try different things. But now that we have Leonard and we also have Tabaris, our urban farmer for Fort DuPont, I have more of a overarching role. And mm-hmm. so I get to help farm, but I also get to work a lot with data, which is new for us. I never thought I'd be saying
Tell
that.
Tell them, Avery, we have a very sophisticated planting plan.
Well, I was going to say, when you guys were first planting vegetables, were you like, let's do all of this? And then you were like, yeah, we can't give this away. So we need to rethink what we're planting. How did it all work? And I'm sure Leonard had a lot to say with what you were doing. And then what I really want to know is, how are you getting the food that you're growing into the communities?
Mm-hmm. So for the planting, it started just by trying out. We have pretty systematic outlines. So all of our beds, for example, are the same dimensions, so we can track poundage really easily. We can track if something's going wrong. And now our database, through Julie's brilliance, has been...
It's like a little love fest in here.
It is.
I love it. It's so nice.
If you would see us our first year trying to operate the system, I mean, it's a multiple sheets of data. Every bed is outlined from now until December. We know the pounds that are going to Chef Amy. We know pounds that are going to Leonard's farm. We know pounds coming out of Tabaris's farm. So everything is being tracked, and it's a fun system to watch move. Because if we're doing that job really well, then we can guarantee our community members, you will have food.
Okay, so before we get into why Amy is receiving food from you, because it's the initial part of our conversation, we talked about that your goal was to get fresh vegetables to these communities that have low access. I want to talk about how, now that you're growing the vegetables mm-hmm. and you have these two farms and you have a presence in the community, how are you getting the product to the neighborhoods? And how are you gaining access?
Right. We have multiple different roles of getting the food out. So the primary goal was to run farm stands, like Julie was saying. which we do, and our Fort DuPont one's pretty successful. Suleiman Abdul is our market manager, and just like Julie, I ran one farm stand and made $10, and it was Vince who paid me that $10. So Suleiman and Tabaris have been really successful in running our Saturday stands. We used to run it twice a week, and a community member asked us to run a CSA, which is community-supported agriculture. Mm-hmm. So not all of the residents are needing to come to our market with government-subsidized funds. There's a mixed socioeconomic community, and so the people who are already about our mission, confident that they wanted our food, wanted guaranteed food every week. So we started that program. And then we haven't started our Fort Stanton market, but Leonard can speak to that.
But we also get grants, right? So mm-hmm. Last year we were able to secure a grant that allowed us to provide 2,500 pounds of free food into the community as well.
And how does that get executed? How are you able to get the food into the hands of the people who need it?
So through Leonard and Annie, we have made a decision actually, because we do run farm stands, we don't want to give food directly to individuals because we don't want that weird thing of sometimes I can get it free and sometimes I can't.
Right.
But Annie and Leonard will go out and they'll give large amounts of food to groups. So when he goes out to the ANC meetings, or we'll go to a church or whatever and drop off, a large box and then allow it to be distributed through that.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Leonard.
Yeah, we absolutely distribute to trusted members of the community that have a rapport with their community, mm-hmm. and they're usually resourceful people that the community can kind of rely on for things other than foods. So it's just a plus, you know. So.
Well, let me also ask, and we were talking a little bit about this off air, since both of these communities there is some struggle financially in these communities, and with what little funds they do have, you know, they do go for food that has longer shelf life and is more processed because it's less expensive. Are there products that you are growing that, I mean, you don't want to get fresh fruits and vegetables into the hands of that, of these deserving people and them not knowing what to do with it. You don't want it to go to waste. So is there another educational stream, Leonard?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to go back to training.
Mm-hmm.
When I got there, I knew nothing about Swiss chard, some of this, you know, hackerei, turnips, and things of that nature. So
everybody's learning. I mean,
yeah,
you know?
But when you come from a food desert, mm-hmm. when you're used to eating processed, you know, from convenience stores, and, you know, you're lucky to get a tomato or onion at a convenience store.
Sure.
So when you start seeing a wide variety of produce, my thing was to try to grow the regular stuff that we normally eat within our community and then introduce them to other products as, you know, they become more aware of, you know.
Well, and I assume there's some trust involved, right? So, I mean, if you're growing vegetables that people aren't interested in eating or aren't, you know, they're like, I don't like that. I don't want that. If you give them just unknown things, I mean, nobody wants something that nobody wants to feel silly when it comes to food. Do you know what I mean?
Of course. And on the business end, it's almost like business 1-on-1. You know, it's supply and demand.
Sure.
If you're growing a whole lot of stuff that no one can recognize or, you know, holding back on their pocketbook that's already thin,
mm-hmm.
you know, so, you know, it's a thing of just trying the old and introducing the new. Even if you had to give it to them.
But I'll say this.
I say free.
This year during our winter planning, though, Leonard actually changed what we were growing. And he didn't change it, but he introduced a new strategy. He said, listen, if we want people to step up to the table, then there has to be a table full of collards and kale. And he said, yes, we will get other things introduced as well, but there better be collard and kale on the table or nobody's even going to walk up to the table.
Well, I mean, you want to have access to a community. You want to know what they're eating or what they're familiar with, then you have to start there.
Yep. So,
you know,
based on that, we doubled our collard and kale this year.
Amazing. That is really amazing. And then, so how does the job training, I know you have, how does this job training program Leonard and Avery obviously are part of that process, but how does that fit into what you're doing? And then I want to like go from there to where does Amy fit in? Because I feel like Amy has access to lots of vegetables. So where does Amy fit in? Chef Amy Brandwine from Centralina.
Well, from a job training standpoint, it's very much important for our organization as to be part of the community. And so as a non-community resident myself, it's not impactful for me to be there actually executing the plan. And so the job training is very essential because, as I mentioned before, we can create this microeconomic niche and then empower people and really allow the organization to be what the community wants it to be, as opposed to what an outsider would want it to be. Mm-hmm. And so we're able to do that because we've found people with passion that want to be part of our mission, that do live in the neighborhood, and they're driving the plan. And so it's been fabulous. As for Amy, Amy has come to us in a way where she's able to support our mission by buying our food. So we grow organic food, though not actually labeled organic.
Not certified, but that's
not
okay.
Not certified.
Right.
Okay, but I would like to think we have a very high-quality product, very local source. And 75% of our food last year did go into the neighborhoods, but it also went to neighborhoods at highly subsidized rates. We make it very affordable, and we do accept subsidized payments and things like that. But Chef Amy is willing to pay us what she pays others' sources.
The premium price.
Yes, they're premium prices.
Well, so Amy, I'm going to ask Leonard, I'm going to steal that mic from you so Amy can take it over. Amy, how did you find out what DC Urban Greens was doing, and how were you like, oh, I mean, we could do something here?
Well, luckily, you know, I got a phone call from a friend of mine, Pamela Hess at Arcadia Farms, and she said there's a farm that they're growing greens in DC. Would you be interested in working with them? And I was like, well, absolutely.
Can I interrupt? Because Pamela Hess is a force.
Yeah.
And what they're doing,
she is such a connector. She is awesome.
She puts people together all the time. Mm-hmm. And she is with Arcadia, which is out in Virginia. And they too grow fruits and vegetables out on the farm at our at Woodland Farm. And they bring it in to
primarily Ward 8 via their mobile market.
They have a mobile market.
Which has been very successful.
I only know so much about it. I mean, not because I know Pamela Hess personally, but when they were constructing that farm, my son worked on the farm for 6 months.
Oh, nice.
He laid manure.
Awesome.
For 6 months. He pushed poop around. It was great. Sorry. So
no,
go ahead.
So, I mean, this has just been an incredible experience. I mean, I've been... like I said, I'm a Washingtonian, so I spent a good deal of time in urban environments, and I come from a high school, T.C. Williams High School, who had, you know, the richest of the rich and the poorest of the poor all hanging out together, and that was such a wonderful experience for me because I really got to experience the world. So, you know, I've done so much work delivering. I used to do a lot of work for So Others Might Eat, delivering food into the food deserts for holidays, and I always understood that people were hungry. So when this happened and Pamela introduced us, I was like, this is a perfect way for me to connect all the things that I'm passionate about all in one. So cooking, growing vegetables, helping those in need. And it was just like an automatic thing. And so you know, it shouldn't be that Centralina or other, you know, places like mine are the only places, or people who go to these places, that's the only way you can get a fresh vegetable. So I also started to really sort of think about the farmers markets, the ones that are in DC, where they're located, the prices, and if that really makes sense. And I decided that I don't think that that's the right message for Washington in terms of how we go about telling the story of farmers inside Washington, D.C. So I really felt like D.C. Urban Greens is a story that needs to be told, meaning like their farm is 4.7 miles away from Washington, from Centralina. And
Within the city limits.
And it's within the city limits, and it's 4 miles away. So they're growing spinach for us, and I'm serving it to all my customers and I'm telling them that it was grown in Washington, D.C. And they're like, their minds are blown, and they don't really quite understand it, because when Pamela introduced us, I certainly had no idea that the farm even existed. And I'm a longtime Washingtonian. I like to think I know about pretty much everything that's interesting going on in the city. And I thought, well, this is wrong that nobody knows that this farm exists. Like, this should be amplified, and everybody should know that this farm exists. What they're doing, how they're doing it, is so important. And so my whole mission and goal is, first of all, to help them grow more vegetables, to help serve their communities, and also to make everybody aware that there are, to me, they're a small business. So there's a small business inside the food desert that is growing vegetables, that is employing members of their community, that is teaching, that it literally you can walk up and say, this is what a carrot looks like when it comes out of the ground. And that's an experience that people in those neighborhoods, and even people who are in Washington, don't have the opportunity to see. And so the only way to connect with food is to be able to touch it, to be able to feel it, to be able to smell it. And I really feel like that's the most important part of this, is besides growing and feeding people, is making the connection of what a vegetable is coming out of the earth. And then all of a sudden, people start to think about vegetables differently. You know, they start to become connected with what
kids
is going
especially,
on.
Children Absolutely. Especially, when children are involved in, which is why school gardens have been so successful across not just DC, but in the nationally, it's become a national trend thanks to Michelle Obama. And you know, when kids grow a product, take care of it, take it out of the ground, and cook it, instead of being like, "Ew, vegetables." They take pride, and they can bring it home and show their parents, look what I learned today. Look,
we've been super fortunate to be able to share that experience with a bunch of kids via our farm to school field trip program.
I would like to know a little bit more about the farm to school field trip.
Avery would love
to tell
will
you tell me, please? I just think that this is something that all schools in all regions should be taking a part of. It should be a part of every curriculum.
I agree. DC Greens actually certifies other farms for farm to school certification. So with
which we are not, right? We're DC Urban Greens.
You're DC Urban Greens.
There is a DC Greens.
That's Lauren Beale,
yes,
right?
Which is also a fabulous organization.
She does amazing work too. Absolutely. Right. Listen, there's lots of good groups in this city. Everybody has very good intentions. And what I love about this city, and I know it very well in the chef community, but I know with the charitable organizations as well, is that while everybody may be fighting for dollars, everybody knows that the cause is good. Mm-hmm. So if you can help each other or work together or partner in ways, because at the end of the day, your ultimate goal is to get food to people who need it. Mm-hmm. So everybody needs to get on board together to make that happen.
Absolutely.
So please continue, Avery.
Right. And DC Greens has been that for us, especially with this curriculum program, because we're new to that. So they're a helpful resource. But through this certification, we're able to host farm-to-school field trips that teachers can either apply for grants to say, okay, this farm is certified. They're going to be teaching curriculum that goes along with our science classes. And so they can be awarded money to come from the government. Or right now we have a private school just across the street from our farm, Cornerstone, and we teach a garden elective every Friday. Again, it's the standard curriculum that DC schools need, but it's tailored towards interaction on our farm. It's tailored towards what we actually need done.
And those are high school kids, right?
Those are high school kids. So we have curriculum based for elementary and high school. And anything above that, they're basically just volunteers. And so all of our curriculum, for example, today the kids were learning about, last week they learned about how important soil is. And today they're learning how to, and so they would mix soil, they would touch it, they would help us with our soil blocks, and then today they're transplanting plants. So they're learning about root structure and photosynthesis, but it's actually getting work done for us too.
Right.
So it's really helpful.
It's a little bit of labor while you're
right.
at
so it. That connection that Amy was talking about to food, I mean, it's we're able to provide that not just from the plucking of the carrot, but from the planting of the carrot.
Now, Amy, do you, now that you're working with DC Urban Greens, do you say to them, okay, so this is what this is my wish list. And does that help them? Like, I mean, because...
Yeah. No, I have...
You know what I mean? Like, you're like, this is what I'd like you to grow for me.
Well, it's every chef's dream to have a farm that that you say, I'd really love it if you could grow this. And then, you know, it's a luxury. We go, last year we did a planting, we had a planting meeting. So we just talked about the things that I was interested in. And, you know, the soil of this area, if you, you know, tomatoes sometimes grow depending on this, how the season is. And so
I don't know about you guys. I can't get a tomato to grow.
Well, no, that's what I'm saying.
The life of me. It doesn't matter what I do.
Mid-Atlantic, I'm not a farmer. But right. What I know about, just from my own backyard, because I have my own little urban garden, mm-hmm. but, you know, I couldn't grow certain things. But, you know, the it's not the easiest climate to farm in, right? So I have a wish list, and I tell Avery and Julie, like, kind of what I love, what I'm interested in. And then we go about seeing how the season goes and then what's available. And then whatever's available, I take it and I work with it and create wonderful food with it. So I'm not asking them to, like, I want this kind of carrot and I'm only going to take that kind of carrot. That's not how we go about doing things. But I have a wish list. If it happens, if the climate works out and the soil's good and all this stuff, then it grows well, we do it. And then, but whatever they have available for me, I buy. So they have beautiful beet greens that were like, you know, when I first met them, so Pamela introduced us, and then we went to visit them at their farmer's stand on Pennsylvania Avenue. They're outside the Reagan building.
Yes.
And they had a little basket of vegetables. They had zucchini and a tomato and some other things. And I said, they gave me the basket, and like they were so nervous. And I was like,
we were so nervous.
They were so
She's
nervous.
Really scary. I mean, I can see why. Totally. All like 5'1" of you, you're frightening.
No, they were really nervous to give me these beautiful vegetables. And I said, I'll take. I this is amazing. They're like, well, here's the beet greens, and they're like these perfect, perfect beet greens. They're like, you know, only 2 inches big, and you know, they were just so nervous if it was going to be good enough for me. And then they were like gorgeous, and the spinach is gorgeous, and the product's amazing. But you know, the most beautiful thing is that it's clipped and then sent over, and to talk about freshness of product, I mean, the stuff is squeaking when it gets to my door. It's like talking to me.
I love it. Do all your listeners know that Amy creates a new menu every single day based on availability?
They do now.
And so what makes her so amazing for us is that she will take whatever we have and then design her menu with what's available.
Well, that's why she has a James Beard nomination. I mean, you know, she works very hard to do what she does. And she's much appreciated in the DC food community, as is what you all are doing. So let's, as we wrap this up, long-term goals for DC Urban Greens. What can we expect from you, let's say, a year from now? What are we hoping to see?
Well, from us, we've really been working hard to maximize the spaces in which we grow, not only from a food volume perspective, but from a programming perspective. And so we are not looking to immediately expand to new space and take on additional farms until I am so stubborn. We are going to max out the spaces that we have and optimize our resources and optimize the funding. And that's what we are really focused on right now.
Well, that's terrific. But I would assume that a lot of people are like, no, come plant a garden here. Are there more people who are coming to you in the community? Leonard, I just want to throw this back to you and asking for farms closer to them.
Yes. Going to the meetings, when you start talking about growing, you know, you learn about other people's small gardens or their ambitions to grow. And oftentimes, at the meetings, we do take vegetables and stuff like that, so they get a chance to taste it,
mm-hmm.
and we grow pretty well. So oftentimes they want, you know, our expertise to come out and help them start their gardens, which is fine. But sometimes you have to realize it's only one me.
You know, of course.
So I'm very, very cautious with my words. You mm-hmm. know, I come out and help, and it's just basically the knowledge that was kind of freely given to me by DC Urban Greens. And I feel like I'm just doing my duty by passing it on to those in the community, letting them understand and realize that you can actually grow and actually do this yourself
mm-hmm.
if you just take the proper steps that was taught to me. So I'm very cautious, you know, because it's a lot of labor in growing. But at the same time, I have a passion for helping my community, and I know that it's needed. So I do whatever I can to help out.
Well, I want to thank you and thank all of you for, the work that you're doing is so important, and it's a small step that will eventually be a much larger step for changing the food access in this city. Lastly, Julie, I just want to ask you, how can people get involved with DC Urban Greens?
Well, they can volunteer, absolutely, by going sending an email to info@dcurbangreens.org, and mm-hmm. that will go to our community outreach director, Annie Lee, and she can correspond with them from then. They can absolutely go to the website, click donate, and put a whole bunch of zeros after
everybody donate.
Number.
I'm hearing a big call for donations.
So, but those are our current needs. Yeah.
Okay, great. So everybody needs to get involved. This is an incredibly big issue in the DC metro region. Nationally it's a problem, but we know close at home it is too, and we all have the ability to affect change. So I want to thank all of my guests for coming in today. I want to thank Amy Brandline from Centralina, first of all, for bringing this issue to the forefront and working so closely with us on it.
I have one last plug.
Okay, one last plug. Make it. I got to wrap this up.
June, we're having our third annual, Centralina's having their third anniversary, and also we're going to have a harvest dinner with DC Urban Greens. We do this every season, and what they grow, we're going to harvest, and then we're going to have a meal at the restaurant.
So fantastic. Okay, so we'll stay tuned. Obviously, here's my plug. You can find information on that on the list, areyouonit.com. because we always feature everything that Amy is doing on there. I want to thank Julie Kirkwood and Avery Snipes and Leonard Watson also for joining us today. What you all are doing is amazing, and I can't wait to hear how your organization continues to grow. I want to thank all of you for listening in today. This is Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I'm Nikki Nellis. I am Beastless, which is becoming a regularity, but not always. I'm sure he'll be back next week. Thanks for joining us, and have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.